This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. IU and Purdue are splitting an $840,000 grant from Lilly Endowment to study the ethics of AI, big data, and other adjacent big tech advances. Can these initiatives affect real change in the fast-paced world of big tech? We'll get some insight from today's panel. Joining me now from West Lafayette is David Reingold, Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Purdue University. Thanks for joining us, David.
Glad to be here.
And from Bloomington, we have Nathan Ensminger, Associate Professor and Chair of the School of Informatics at Indiana University. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.
And Fred Cates. Fred is Vice President for Research and Professor of Law at Indiana University. Thank you, Fred.
It's a pleasure.
And, of course, we want to hear from you. You can comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get to as many messages in front of our panel as we can this hour. Fred, we're going to start with you. Can you explain what this initiative is and how it happened?
Well, I hope so. The initiative actually came from Lilly Endowment Incorporated. They've been very concerned about the role of ethics in both education and society for some time now. And the Lilly Endowment approached both IU and Purdue and with an idea about ways of increasing the extent to which we teach about the development of character, about difficult issues concerning values and ethics, and particularly around what you might think of as digital issues. So the digital technologies we find every day, whether it's on our phones or using the internet or in medicine or healthcare or many other walks of life. And so the notion here is not to do in-depth research on this subject. There's been a lot already discovered and known about this. It's rather to work together to figure out how better to inform our students, to engage them in these difficult issues, and to be perfectly frank, to help prepare them for a life that's going to be increasingly dominated by these digital issues and the difficult issues they raise.
So it looks pretty broad. You're looking at basic societal interaction with smartphones and social media and whatnot, all the way to industry advancements and scientific advancements, and all the way even to the future. What do you hope to accomplish at the end of this particular project?
Well, I think what we really view this as is a way of equipping students to be better prepared to deal with these issues. There are no right answers here. And moreover, even if we thought there were, the technologies are going to change again and again during the course of someone's life. So what our goal here is to really help prepare them to be able to recognize important challenges, to gather the information they need to make intelligent decisions, and then to give them some sense of a framework or a set of questions you might ask about a difficult issue. And so, you know, this could be everything from as ordinary as how do I communicate online? You know, we know anonymous communications tend to cause people to be more shrill. This has much more divisive effects in our political debate and in communities. All the way to really sophisticated questions about questions involving healthcare, the use of technology in healthcare, or workplace issues that people might face if they're designing a system that, for example, might be used as an autonomous weapon. What are the rational questions that a good thinking human being would ask about these types of activities?
David, can you explain what Purdue will focus on for their part in this initiative?
Yes, absolutely. So we're really – well, we're delighted to be a part of this effort and working with our colleagues in Bloomington with the support of the Lilly Endowment. And, you know, Purdue, as I think a lot of people in the audience know, is a heavily a STEM-centric university. We have one of the largest student populations that are focused in the STEM area. We have this background of being the home of the first computer science department dating back to 1962. And we're very interested and want to work on developing curricula and educational programs that can help better prepare our students, particularly those in the STEM domains, to have the kind of not only the technological background, but also a background in professional ethics, and to be leaders and budding leaders who can help bridge the divide between this ethical debate and the possibilities of technology. And so we're really looking to try and build a curriculum engaging experts in industry, in government, in the defense world, as well as the academy, to try and pull together what we believe will be a sort of a leading curriculum for students so that they can go out and be a part of shaping not only what we can create, but what we should create.
Nathan, you're chair of the School of Informatics at IU. Informatics has been around for a while, but just in case our listeners don't know, can you describe what informatics are?
Sure. So our school is the Luddy School of Informatics, Computing, and Engineering, and people tend to know what computer science and engineering are, but informatics is kind of a new word, or at least it's new in the United States. And informatics is really about intersections. So our students get a foundation in computing and technology, but then they intersect with other areas, whether that's kind of entrepreneurship or the sciences or the humanities. And so our students are kind of inherently interested in ways they can use their technical skills to change the world in particular ways. And I think that's a great foundation. We have 1,600 undergraduate majors, maybe another 300 or 400 graduate students, all of whom are going to be kind of central in building this new world. And so the idea that we can get these students when they're young and get them thinking about these issues is really important. It's a part of the larger mission of Lilly, but I think for me in particular, it's the ideal place in which to start.
The idea behind informatics seems similar in some ways to the idea behind this new initiative. The computer technology is becoming less of an isolated field as time goes on. Everyone needs to know about it and to think about it, no matter what they're studying. How have the dramatic changes we've seen in the last couple decades changed what education looks like at colleges like IU?
Right. So I think this is a case where this consortium, this project, IU and Purdue, has a chance to kind of lead really the entire world. So we have been doing this kind of interdisciplinary approach for decades, and it does change. It changes the way you teach students. So for example, all of our informatics students already take an ethics course as part of their training. They take courses in the social sciences. They're intersecting probably more with the arts and humanities than you might if you were in, say, an engineering program. So yes, our curriculum has changed. And when we talk to employers and graduate schools, they're always asking for more of the interdisciplinarity than they are for more technical skills. They're saying, teach your students about communication, teach them about ethics, teach them about the law and policy and the things that kind of you need to create products that are sustainable over the long term.
Are schools adapting fast enough, do you think, to weave technology into all the fields that they need to?
No, I don't think so. And I think one of the products of this project will be a set of tools or an infrastructure or resources for all the universities who want to teach this stuff but don't know how. And I think if we can build a foundation that other people can use, it will kind of magnify the impact of this particular investment.
David, what about Purdue? How have you seen technology, especially computer technology, have an effect on areas of the school that it didn't used to?
Well, our students take a lot of classes, obviously, in computer science, in electrical engineering, and data science, and beyond. And you know, we're very mindful that many of these students, you know, are going to go on to be the leaders of the tech world, and you know, we're taking very seriously this question of, you know, what virtues should be incorporated into their experiences here and into their professional lives moving forward. We are also very mindful that, you know, many of our corporate partners at the university are leading in a variety of domains in artificial intelligence and big data. And they are scrambling to, you know, set up professional ethics review boards and hire professional ethics officers and to oversee the creation of the corporate principles that are going to govern their institutions. And so, you know, we're trying to work hand in glove with them to make sure that we are cultivating and developing the kinds of educational material that can sort of prepare us for that next you know, sometimes it's referred to as the fourth industrial revolution. So, you know, our students are obviously, you know, they're very much at the front edge of this technological work, and we want to make sure that our disciplines of philosophy and history and sociology, our Brian Lamb School of Communication, our political science department, our anthropology department, are orienting their work and integrating with our colleagues in the physical sciences and in the engineering sciences.
Is it a challenge to get some people in engineering and other scientific STEM fields, which you could definitely characterize as more technical and fact-based than other areas of study? Is it a challenge to get them to dive into something as murky as ethics?
Well, I don't actually think so. I think that this is, you know, I mean, you can't open up a newspaper or turn on the TV, you know, without bumping into a story these days without, you know, in any given day or a week, without being confronted with a story about sort of the world of technology, particularly artificial intelligence and big data and how it's interacting with the domain of ethics and human decision making and sort of what the right thing to do is. You know, we have developed at Purdue a new certificate program called Cornerstone, which is designed to try and bridge the STEM domain with the more traditional domains of the humanities and the social sciences, and students take a year-long course in reading some of the most interesting material that's been produced and work on their writing and their oral communication. And then they can take three additional classes in a curated, focused way, satisfying between 60%, 75% of their core curriculum for the university through that certificate program. So we have 2,000 students that are in that first year this semester. It's a program that we're in our second year of implementing. So we are taking that very seriously as we try and bridge those worlds.
We'll keep the conversation going. Lots to talk about today. We're talking with faculty leaders at Purdue University and Indiana University about a new initiative to study the ethics around technology. Up next, we'll learn more about what each school wants to learn from all this, starting with a look at the complicated future of artificial intelligence. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on the ethics around technology, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. We also caught up with Indiana Public Broadcasting's environmental reporter, Rebecca Thiel, on some reporting she did on the ArcelorMittal cyanide spill near Indiana Dunes National Park. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about a new initiative at Purdue and IU to study the ethics around technology, from artificial intelligence to self-driving cars. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. We'll try to get them in front of our live panel. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Speaking of our live panel, we're joined again by David Reingold, Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Purdue University. From Bloomington, we have Nathan Ensminger, Associate Professor and Chair of the School of Informatics at IU, and Fred Kate. He's the Vice President for Research and Professor of Law at Indiana University. Thank you all for joining us again. Okay, David. Let's get into the issue you're focusing on at Purdue for your part in this project, which is artificial intelligence. This is a term that's thrown around a lot and has been for a long time. But there's a gap between something like a smartphone assistant that reads you the weather and the powerful AI that might help neuroscientists break new ground. What's Purdue going to look at specifically?
Well, we're mindful that a lot of AI systems are self-governing in many ways and evolving, and there's a real desire on the part of consumers and the world out there to actually know who's in charge. How individuals who are engaged in developing these kinds of technologies and how they're interacting with the public is and the public's expectations are, I think, you know, critically important. And, you know, we are not necessarily in our sort of role in this going to be the ones that are going to be providing the answers to you know, what should the ethical principles of AI be. We are going to be trying to bring together sort of leading figures from the academy, from business, from government, from the defense world and private industry to help us try and stitch together, you know, what do the technologists and the engineers and the individuals who are building today's AI systems and tomorrow's AI systems, what do they need to know and how to think about their role and responsibility in putting those things together?
And how important is AI right now in the fields of study at Purdue?
Oh, I mean, it is in some ways ubiquitous. You know, we have several computer science. Well, you know, we obviously have a very large electrical engineering program, the large computer science program, the large computer technology program. And when you sort of see how those units sort of interact across campus, I mean, it is a very, very sort of fast-growing and ubiquitous domain.
Nathan, I understand the point of some of this collaboration is to make sure that the two schools aren't duplicating efforts, but I'm sure that AI will come up to some degree at IU, correct?
Most definitely. We, as part of the new gift that established the Luddy School, or named the Luddy School of Informatics, Computing, and Engineering, was something like $23 million towards a new center for artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is becoming a tool that's used across the sciences and many of the social sciences and even some of the humanities. So it's hard to avoid its presence at any university or across the university.
How would you characterize AI right now in terms of how advanced it is and how much of an impact it's having on the world?
Well, I think that's complicated because AI means lots of things, and it's a kind of hot topic. So many people talk about what they do in terms of AI, and it may or may not be AI. I think what is productive about this conversation at across these two universities is just opening up the fact that anything that is artificial intelligence related is always embedded in other kinds of systems. So, for example, if you think about autonomous vehicles, we tend to focus on the vehicle and maybe the AI that's behind the driving of a vehicle. But if you think about the role of the automobile in our society, you think about what makes automobiles safe, the way we think about fairness and equity and sustainability, the way the automobile has changed our culture and society, vehicles are part of that, but so are policies and infrastructure and education and human behavior and anthropology and sociology. And so what we'd like to do is to say whatever comes with, say, autonomous vehicles, AI will be part of a larger system, some of which will change dramatically and some of which will remain quite constant over time. And so I think that's the value of AI as a big, broad umbrella that encompasses everything from the computer sciences to the life sciences to biomedicine and the arts. And I think that's what this project will do by bringing together a big part of this project is bringing together lots of parties who might otherwise do their research in isolation.
Purdue will focus on issues around data management as well, big data. And this is another term that's been around for a while, and its definition continues to evolve. David, what is big data in 2019?
Well, we've had a fairly substantial effort across the campus in data science, which is, you know, is still unfolding in many ways, as I said, as the home of the first computer science department in the United States. And I mean, you know, we've had some discussions, although I'll leave it for others, of, you know, whether or not all students should be exposed to a certain set of classes in the data science space. I mean, I think for us, you know, having the flagship public universities of the state, you know, engaged on this important topic, you know, is, I think, I don't want to lose sight of how I think how important that is. And I think it really does suggest just how high a priority these topics are for us. And ultimately, you know, what we're trying to do is to ensure that our preparing students for their careers, it puts them in a position to help improve the lives of the people that they are engaging with, and to develop character in our students as well as in professionals who are working in this space, so that they can improve the general welfare.
It seems like most of the big data issues that get talked about in the U.S. involve social media. Companies like Facebook, they make a lot of money selling data about their users, which has caused plenty of concern about privacy and security. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I think that's just the world that we're in. And I guess, you know, I don't necessarily think that we have any interest in placing restrictions on commerce as it relates to data. And I think what we want to do is try and prepare people to be able to make sound decisions and to guide the organizations, institutions, and the practices that they're engaged in ways that are helpful and constructive for the general welfare.
In the last few years, there have been some prominent figures in the tech world, Elon Musk being one of the more prominent, that have issued warnings about AI getting too powerful. Some people are worried basically that we'll lose control of the thing that we're making and it could be disastrous. David, what do you think?
Well, I'm not a historian, and I'll defer to my colleagues. One of the reasons I think why we want to engage our colleagues in history and in philosophy and in some other domains is that they have they have the context and the experience, and knowing how a variety of technologies have affected human organization, social organization, and human progress. And I think we can learn from those. I think there have always been doomsdayers out there. I don't think that that's anything new. And whether or not we're facing more challenging doomsday scenarios, I'll sort of let others prognosticate on. But I think there's a lot that we can learn from, and our students can learn from what's happened in the past, and to apply it in some measure to what's happening today and in the future.
Fred, you've worked on matters of digital policy for a long time. What do you make of the current conversations around AI and some of the people predicting where it's all going to go?
Well, in many ways, I would echo what David said, which is there's always somebody saying the sky is falling. And that doesn't mean the sky is not falling. It just means the fact people are saying it is not evidence of that fact. I do think we're looking at increasingly powerful technologies. We're looking at computing technologies. We're looking at uses for big data. I flew recently to London. I flew the entire way there and back without ever needing a document. You know, the airlines recognized my face when I got on the plane. The U.S. Customs recognized my face when I landed. There was never a need for a passport, no driver's license. And that works great when it works. But think about then when it doesn't work. Think about when somebody, for example, these facial recognition technologies work much less well with dark-skinned people. Think about the people who were left out of these, if you will, technological advances. So it's not just a question of the sky is falling, like are we going to put an end to life as we know it. It's also a question of, are we creating inequalities as we move forward? Are we creating systems that may be less just or less fair? We've seen a great deal of this about interactions between citizens and police. And really, it's been the advent of the digital camera that's really brought about this huge recent change in the way that we view these, because now we can suddenly see them. But now the question is, who's got cameras? And the police have cameras and individuals have cameras. We've kind of kept this situation equal. These are the types of challenges as we move forward. And again, I think part of the key point here, and it's true about AI, it's true about big data, it's true about a lot of these issues, And that is, we're not just confronting them in, if you will, technical areas. It's not just computer scientists who's confronting them. It's not just people who will work with Facebook. It's all of us. It's all of us who are buying technologies and using them. It's all of us who are using social media. It's all of us who are being confronted with decisions to make on an everyday basis. You know, do you bring a device into your home that listens to your voice? Do you bring a smart TV into your home that watches your gestures? What do you do about phishing emails that appear to be from somebody else? Do you respond now? Do you even answer your phone if you don't recognize who's calling? And so these are questions that part of answering them means being aware of the issues, having basic knowledge, basic competence in these issues. And it also means having a certain, if you will, skepticism. And so one of the things I think that's really great about what the Lilly Endowment has done here and about the way both Purdue and IU are responding, and that is, I mean, think about it. David is dean of liberal arts at Purdue. We have brought in the whole university. You know, here I am vice president for research, for all research, for medical research, for English research, for everything. We're not going to approach these issues just by staying in one silo, just lawyers talking to lawyers or computer scientists talking to computer scientists. It's only going to be by broadening out this dialogue that we're going to create the sensitivity and the competence that we need to equip people for these issues in the future.
Let's go back to some of those specific devices. What do you think that devices like Amazon Echo and Google Home are having on our comfort levels about inviting some kind of artificial intelligence into our home? There are definitely people who want to remain completely uninterested in having a device in their home that can recognize their voice, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think there's a we live in a world of a rich diversity of views, and you really see it when you get to these technological questions. So, for example, I wouldn't have a device in my home that listened to my voice and responded to it, because I would worry about it listening when I didn't intend it to be, or who was it sharing that conversation with. On the other hand, I carry a phone with me. The phone's got a microphone. The microphone can be turned on very easily, either accidentally or deliberately. And yet somehow I feel comfortable with that. You could say this is a way of dealing that's really informed by ignorance. If I really thought it through, I might say, look, in for a penny, in for a pound. If I'm going to have one, why not get the convenience of another one? I think another thing we need to think about, particularly with artificial intelligence, it's all around us already. We see it operating. We see it operating at borders. We see it operating in business. We see it operating, you know, your phone that recognizes your face. That's artificial intelligence at work. Your phone that recognizes your voice. That's artificial intelligence at work. Yet whenever we are knowingly confronted with it, I was reminded yesterday, I went to the zoo in the morning. I came home. I downloaded my pictures. And my computer tried desperately to use artificial intelligence to identify those pictures. And it was wrong 4/5 of the time. It was amazingly wrong. It was laughingly wrong much of the time. I took a picture of a chipmunk crossing a path, and the label it gave me was squirrel at the beach. It got the animal wrong. It got the setting wrong. And so I think it's when we are confronted with this, it makes us naturally skeptical. Yet somehow when we're encountering it in ways where it's not labeled artificial intelligence, where it's built into our phone or it's built into our smart devices at home, suddenly we become more trusting or more reliant on it than at least at present the facts may justify. So the great thing about, I think, what we're trying to do is not to provide answers, not to say, should you have a smartphone? Should you have a digital assistant at home, but rather to say, what are the types of questions a person would ask, and how do you reflect on your own values? So, for example, if you have kids at home, you might feel differently about this than if you don't have kids at home. If you, you know, depending upon, people who feel more vulnerable, people who may have an ex-spouse who they're trying to stay away from may have a different set of answers to these questions. The point is to ask intelligent questions informed by knowledge. And I think that's what we are all about here, both at IU and Purdue.
Nathan, is this the kind of thing that people just get used to with time? To some, that's not really a positive thing, that technology is advancing so quickly and becoming so crucial in our lives that we're giving up privacy and security that we never would have given up otherwise.
I do think there's a sense of change in the pace of technological innovation, which can lead to a kind of powerlessness or a sense of powerlessness that I don't have any choice anymore, that companies are building these things and I have to follow along. And I think that's at the heart of any conversation about ethics or values or responsibility or character are questions of choice and human agency. And a really important element of this project will be to reintroduce all of the ways in which human beings are, in fact, building these systems. They're not happening to us. They are being built. Now, different kinds of people have different kinds of power. Obviously, an engineer at Google has more ability to shape these technologies than I do as a consumer. But both David and Fred have reminded us that these technologies are pervasive. We're all implicated in these ethical decisions about how we use or choose not to use these technologies. And I think claims that AI is inevitable and that it's inordinately powerful are in some ways claims that technologists want to make in order to remove conversation about values and ethics and choice. And so I think this project will really kind of open up the ability of not just different academic disciplines, but different kinds of participants in this dialogue about what we want the future to look like and our role in shaping that.
We're talking today about a new initiative at Purdue University and Indiana University to study the ethics around technology. David Reingold from Purdue University and Nathan Ensminger and Fred Kate from IU will stay with us. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the many intersections of ethics and technology and a new initiative to explore them at Purdue and IU. We're joined again by leaders at both schools. David Reingold is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Purdue University. And from Bloomington, we're talking to Nathan Ensminger, Associate Professor and Chair of the School of Informatics at IU. And Fred Kate is Vice President for Research and Professor of Law at Indiana University. David, one of the issues Purdue will explore is titled Interacting with the Physical Manifestation of AI in the Future of Work and Leisure. What are we talking? Are we talking about robots?
Yes. And, you know, I think we're particularly interested in, you know, how the world how should people be thinking about artificial intelligence and big data within the context of work, as well as the world of leisure. I mean, Fred was sort of just describing a little bit of leisure activity at the zoo, and sort of how the world of AI he's sort of interacting with it. I think, you know, in our worlds of work, it's almost impossible for anybody to show up at work and to not interface with a digital environment that it's increasingly being shaped by the world of AI. I'm mindful that, you know, frequently for those of us who still read newspapers, you know, you can pick up a newspaper article and oftentimes our news is being given to us and written by computers. So there's really no corner of the modern world right now, particularly within the context of work and leisure, where, you know, artificial intelligence and big data isn't playing a role. And so, you know, we're mindful that, you know, sometimes, you know, here in the Rust Belt, sometimes some folks will call it flyover country. You know, they may not sort of think about. They may think about work in a slightly different context. But you know, we want to sort of focus on thinking about and helping our students and professionals in private industry as well as government officials think about, you know, how do they approach the intersection of artificial intelligence and big data and the world of work and leisure.
Fred, what effect do you think it might have on people when artificial intelligence is working inside robots that look a lot more human? I know we're looking way into the future here, but something like that, or at least not more relatable than maybe, say, an inanimate object like Amazon's Echo.
I think actually people are going to be pretty accepting of this on the whole. I mean, think about the success already of kind of what I'm just going to call toys, like robotic dogs and bears that tell you stories and dolls that talk back. These are tremendously well-selling. They raise all sorts of issues because they're collecting lots of data and in many cases sharing that back with their manufacturers. But I think we are used to computers doing more and more things for us. Most of us use them now to, for example, navigate. Every single time I get in my car to drive home from work, even though I only live, 8 minutes away and it's only one straight street, it still gives me directions. And for some reason, I follow those directions because that way I can time how I'm doing getting there. And so the more we get used to relying on these technologies for ordinary things, for things that we might previously have used our own brains or our friends for, I think it's going to be easier and easier to rely on them in other settings. So, for example, video conferencing, a huge advantage. Almost anyone who works in a far-flung institution like either IU or Purdue or most corporations appreciates the great convenience of video conferencing. Well, a next step in that direction is to have a movable robot. It doesn't look human, but it's sort of a little pedestal that moves around. So then you can actually have a conversation with someone who's in a remote location. The robot follows along with you, or it can sit on the other side of the table. It's like having a real person. You know where to look to have the conversation. I was in the Seoul, Korea airport this summer. They use these as if you will, movable kiosks. They do look like people, and you sort of tap them on the shoulder, and they stop, and then they turn around and face you, and they have a little display screen, and they talk, and you can ask them, like, where's my gate, or where is this store, and they answer it. And it doesn't actually feel that awkward that it's a machine. And in fact, I have to say, I became particularly annoyed. I watched some kid sort of slap this robot to try to get its attention. And I'm like, whoa, boy, lighten up there. Just a little touch will do. But it wasn't because I was worried about the machine. It's because I was actually now thinking of the machine as some sort of sentient being because how helpful it had been. And so I think there will be places we will push back on seeing robots. But on the other hand, I think in many ways we will be quite welcoming to having robots that are more a part of our lives and are more visibly robots.
Both artificial intelligence and robots have a strong connection with one of the most important issues we'll talk about today, job automation. Nathan, how should schools study automation in ways they might not be right now?
Well, one of the things I think they need to remind students is that automation is a choice. It's not just driven by the economics of the situation. And so we might want to ask more fundamental questions about what are we automating and why are we automating this kind of work. So I'm part of an NSF study on the future of work in the context of domestic care. So maybe taking care of children or the elderly, and thinking about all the people whose work might be changed by artificial intelligence and robotics in that context. And it's clear that those people are never going to go away. They'll be part of the care of, say, an elderly parent. But that artificial intelligence or robotics could change the nature of the work, either make it more meaningful or more productive, or eliminate the aspects of it that bring joy, that provide human contact. And again, we need to ask ourselves, so why are we automating parts of this? Is it to save money? Is it to start a new business? Or is it to make people's lives better or the provision of care better? And I think recognizing that there are choices, that it's not inevitable that we automate, is absolutely fundamental. And then I think the second part of that is that human beings are part of this work. Even work that we tend to think of as being AI often has a human component, whether it's the humans who are training AI systems to recognize different kinds of humans and in some cases recognizing, say, white humans better than it recognizes humans of color. Or in processing, listening into conversations to do quality control, or even doing some of the processing of image recognition and speech recognition, that human beings are still part of these systems, even though we think of them as being automated or increasingly automated. And I think those two lessons alone are enough to kind of reshape the conversation about away from inevitability and what will AI do to us, towards what do we want AI to do for us and how can we be part of that that conversation.
Let's go back to this idea that automation is a choice for companies. Is it really, though, if all of the companies competing against it are moving in that direction and becoming more efficient as a result?
Yes, I do think so. And I think even in terms of cost and cost accounting, it can be sometimes quite difficult. So labor is a cost that's easy to make tangible. This worker costs so much. The costs of developing software and, more importantly, of maintaining software, maintaining infrastructure, of training, of IT support, it's not entirely clear how those costs get accounted for. And there's, in fact, a big discussion in economics about whether or not IT does – information technologies do, in fact, make us more productive. And a lot of those costs get buried or deferred into the future, particularly maintenance. Think about – for example, the billions of dollars spent on Y2K remediation. This was maintenance that was deferred. A lot of companies that installed computers suddenly realized those computers were a lot more expensive, perhaps, than the humans they replaced. I'm not saying that's true, but I think it's an open question, and that sometimes we get carried away by the idea that technologies are always better solutions than humans.
Nathan, on top of being the chair of the School of Informatics, you're also an historian. When you see these discussions about job automation and artificial intelligence having a profound impact on people, how much of it feels like the same kind of tension that's always come with advancing technology? And how much of it feels completely new?
Well, there are some aspects. So I'm struck by the conversation about work and automation that's happening right now and how much it resembles a conversation that was happening in the 1950s when the word automation was being introduced and when digital computers were becoming part of the kind of landscape of the American corporation. Very similar concerns about the routinization of work, about de-skilling, about the elimination of human jobs. And obviously things changed with the computer, but they didn't change in the ways that people expected. Human beings continued to have jobs. Maybe they did different kinds of jobs or they did those jobs differently. But it didn't have this kind of profound effect on, say, employment that people predicted. And so I'm a little skeptical of claims today. Not that I don't think these are fundamental issues and issues of great importance for policymakers and leaders and academics. But I certainly don't think it's inevitable that this will happen. And again, the language of inevitability can eliminate conversation and choice in ways that I think are really unproductive for us as a society.
A lot of this is about scale, right? Some jobs have become obsolete throughout history as new technology came around, but it seems like AI has the potential to replace a way bigger portion of jobs than anything before it.
That is possibility, and scale is one of the kind of features of this new technological landscape that that our steering committee has kind of identified as being key. So you asked about what is difference, speed, scale, pervasiveness. These are all things that I do think make AI different. The fact that there's so many of these tools that you can buy off the shelf, that you can freely download from the internet, and without even really understanding how they work, you can start to implement in your business or your personal life, is one of the things that does make AI different and I think uniquely frightening to people. It feels out of control in a way that maybe industrial automation, which required big corporations and lots of capital, did not.
Fred, these conversations almost always get to questions about what the government should do. How much should it intervene to protect people from these changes? How would you characterize the state of that conversation right now? Do people seem to be leaning in one direction or the other?
I'd say generally the government's taken a pretty hands-off approach to most technologies, and in a way that's been good. It's probably encouraged the development of them. So, for example, the resistance to taxing internet purchases, or we're only now starting to see sort of regulation coming out of states about online privacy or things like this. I do think it's a challenging issue, though, particularly when you talk about the workplace environment and AI, because there are going to be many, many jobs that AI may make either unnecessary, the machine will actually do it, or that AI will make much faster. And we're not just talking here about like factory jobs. This will be a so, for example, think about reading a radiological image. Most states now have laws that say, you know, an X-ray has to be read by a radiologist in the state. Well, we know AI is pretty good at reading X-rays. That's one thing it's actually quite good at. What are we going to do now? Are we going to continue to have radiologists at great expense read X-rays if they're not needed? Are we going to use AI as a tool to assist radiologists? What is the law going to say? Right now, the law is keeping those people in a job. We see the same thing with a lot of things that attorneys do. I'm an attorney. I would have thought I might be the last type of job that could be replaced by a computer. But a lot of what we do is process documents and look for things and look for keywords and look for documents that respond to a subpoena or respond to a court order. Turns out machines are really good at doing that. And there are thousands of attorneys and paralegals and others who are doing that, who we frankly may have to think of finding other jobs for us. And so the challenge is going to be how we think about this. Do we say, oh, let's just put all those people out of work and deal with it later, kind of the way we did with factory automation? Or are we going to say maybe learning from the degree of disgruntlement and economic hardship that created, we better think this through in advance? And I think that's a perfect example of the type of issue we're looking at in this Lilly Endowment grant, which is, when you're doing something that's gee whiz and exciting but may have clear consequences, like putting a lot of people out of work, how do you think about that? How do you make sure that issue is addressed with? What's your ethical obligation? How do you raise that within a company or a university setting so that we don't just leave it for those people once injured to have to address? These are really hard issues. Many people enjoy the benefits of technology. And of course, almost any interaction with, say, the healthcare system, we see all sorts of tools available now that weren't available a decade ago or 20 years ago. But at the same time, you know, we're now seeing AI being used for group caravans of trucks. And if that means dispossessing 3 million truck drivers in the United States, that's a really serious question. And it's worth thinking about before we take the action.
David, complicated ethical questions around technology seems like an extremely hard topic to study at a university, because conversations about ethics change while our culture changes and technology changes even faster than that. How do you keep these things from being outdated? Do you just have to update it as much as possible?
Well, I think that if you look at a lot of the professional norm setting, whether it's among, let's say, lawyers or physicians, that have developed over the past 100-plus years, I mean, a lot of the ethical parameters in the traditional professions, you know, are these were developed largely through self-organization and normative systems. So this is sort of this is one of the things that defines occupations, in particularly the professional occupations. And, you know, I think one of the things that we need to sort of take, and these things came about in part through some systematic work involving a number of philanthropic organizations and professional associations and sort of the kinds of human organizational connectivity that they sort of can give rise to a common set of expectations around how individuals in a particular part of the economic or social or political sphere actually should behave and should operate. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're going to be looking at and working with our colleagues in private industry and in government and in the academy, in the world of defense and national security, is thinking about how do we help to nurture and cultivate some of that organizational connectivity, and knowing that a lot of this is going to have to exist through our own sort of just human sort of normative work.
David Reingold is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Purdue University. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Pleasure to be here.
Nathan Ensminger, Associate Professor and Chair of the School of Informatics at IU. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you for including me.
And Fred Kate, Vice President for Research and Professor of Law at IU. It was great to talk today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Join us tomorrow at this time when we'll be talking about the state of recycling in the capital city and surrounding areas and some of the efforts to make it better. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana on that. And of course, if you'd like your podcast, find it wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.